Welcome to TCN Talks. The goal of our podcast is to provide concise and relevant information for busy hospice and palliative care leaders and staff. We understand your busy schedules and believe that brevity signals respect. And now, here's our host, Chris Como.
Well, hello and welcome to TCN Talks. This is my favorite time of the month, although this is actually kind of a pivot show, and this show will be airing in February, but it's a first because Mark and I, this is the first time we're doing the show where Mark's no longer publishing Hospice News Today. So welcome, Mark Cohen. Welcome back.
Thanks, Chris. It's always great to be here.
Well, Mark, this is fun. This is, man, you have like a whole month where you're not waking up at 3 a.m. in the morning, and yeah. I just want to commend you again. Like, you know, I was kind of complaining to my wife about, like, this is the hardest show to prepare for. We're going through so many articles and just making sure, you know, what should hospice leaders hopefully not miss. And then I think, what am I complaining about? Mark would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning every day of the week to produce Hospice News Today. So I have nothing to complain about.
Yeah, well, it's good to be getting up at 6 in the morning.
Good deal. Well, Mark, you want to go ahead and go first?
Sure. You know, it's great to be here on TCN Talks, talk about hospice and the broader post-acute sector, how the media are covering them and what hot issues might be lurking on the horizon, even though I'm not publishing Hospice News Today anymore. Like most Januaries, this past month got off to a relatively slow start in terms of hospice coverage, but it was an exciting month nonetheless because I published my last edition of Hospice News Today on December 31, and our friends Court Kastner and Joy Berger began publication on January 1 of their successor publication, Hospice and Palliative Care Today. While remaining true to my mission with Hospice News Today, Court and Joy have made a number of significant changes to the newsletter. They still publish a daily newsletter, one that hits readers' inboxes at 6 a.m. Eastern, 7 days a week. But they also have an interactive website that hosts the content and that will grow in functionality over the months ahead. Unlike Hospice News Today, which was a subscriber-only model with no advertising, Court and Joy have switched to an advertiser-supported model and free subscriptions. So anybody listening to this podcast, if you're not already signed up for a free subscription to Hospice and Palliative Care Today, go to Hospice Palliative Care Today, all one word, hospicepalliativecaretoday.com, and get your free subscription right now. And while you're probably too modest, Chris, I won't be shy in informing listeners of TCN Talks that Teleos Collaborative Network is an inaugural sponsor of Hospice and Palliative Care Today. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Teleos.
Absolutely.
And for any vendors, networks, or providers looking to get in front of a growing daily audience of hospice decision makers, already more than 1,000 strong after a month, go to the website and click on the sponsors tab. And Court will be happy to talk to you about how you can advertise on the website and in the newsletter. Well, so much for the commercial. Now back to our regular programming. Except, of course, since I'm no longer diving headlong into hospice media coverage all day long, we'll be looking at things differently and we hope a more compelling way this year. First, some simple metrics. The Hospice and Palliative Care Today platform provides us with a variety of metrics, and we have to give a hat tip to Court and Joy for sharing their analytics with you and with me for use on these podcasts. Court and Joy are using a somewhat different categorization scheme than I use for the articles they run, but looking just at categories, these are the broad subjects that got the most clicks in January on the new Hospice and Palliative Care Today. Readers clicked through on 34,000 items in January. The top six categories were provider news with 7,600 clicks, clinical news with 4,100 clicks. That included medical marijuana, pharmacy issues, end-of-life doulas, grief, and similar topics. Palliative care provider news, which had 2,500 clicks, research news with 1,600 clicks, general hospice news at 1,200 clicks, and post-acute news at 1,000 clicks. Court and Joy are running a daily encouragement each day, an inspiring thought, which is very much in the spirit of the quotes that you use, Chris, to close each podcast. That category garnered 4,000 clicks in January, which was 12% of all clicks on hospice and palliative care today, which
that's
is a huge
cool.
number. Yeah, I mean, that's
really
just
cool.
a huge number. And I think it speaks to the fact that hospice leaders are interested in scanning the environment are also looking for ways to motivate, to inspire, to encourage themselves, as well as those with whom they work. The analytics also allow us to look at the individual articles that gained the most clicks in January. And considering the newsletter didn't reach 1,000 subscribers until about a week to go in January, the numbers associated with the top few most viewed articles are simply astounding. The most popular article from the political newspaper Politico was headlined, "Federal Scientists Conclude There Is Credible Evidence for Certain Medical Uses of Marijuana." That had 811 clicks. Second place, "CDC Map Shows Dramatic Increase in Illness Nationwide. See Where It's Worse." That had 807 clicks. And that was also from a political newspaper, The Hill. Third place was a blog post from the blog Kevin MD titled "Rosalind Carter's Impact on Caregivers," 770 clicks. And there was a bit of a drop off, but not that much. "Care Planning Issues Top Lists of Hospice Survey Deficiencies," 483 clicks for that hospice news article. "Advanced Care Planning Reaches Underserved Across U.S. from Hospice Foundation of America," and "You Can Complain About It or Lean In, Top Home Health Leaders Brace for 2024. That had 474 clicks and ran originally in Home Healthcare News. And the last one on this list, "Top 5 Hidden Gem Palliative Care News Stories from 2023, which ran in Hospice News and had 434 clicks on the Hospice and Palliative Care Today website. It's worth noting, I think, Chris, that two of the seven most clicked on articles originated in political publications, and that the third most clicked on item was from a blog, and that only three of the seven most popular items were actually published in widely read trade publications. So why is that? Might be because lots of readers also subscribe to those trade papers, their daily or weekly newsletters, and they'd already seen the articles. It might be because hospice leaders and decision makers are following public policy issues more closely these days. Probably a little bit of both, actually. Ignoring the roadmap provided by the Hospice and Palliative Care Today analytics, my observations from my perspective on messaging, public relations, and issues management, includes the following. M&A news declined in coverage in January, which is to be expected with the end of the year slowdown in transactions like that. Very few people want to be doing due diligence on Christmas Eve. Negative coverage of skilled nursing facilities and their various problems continued unabated in January. And we have to realize or accept that at some point and to some degree, that stain from skilled nursing is going to spread throughout the care continuum.
Thank you to our TCN Talk sponsor, Delta Care Rx. Delta Care Rx is also the title sponsor for our April and November 2024 Leadership Immersion courses. Delta Care Rx is primarily known as a national hospice PBM and prescription mail order company. Delta Care Rx is a premier vendor of TCN and provides not only pharmaceutical care, but also niche software innovations that save their customers time, stress, and money. Thank you, Delta Care Rx, for all the great work you do in the end of life and serious illness care.
Coverage of medical aid in dying came roaring back in January after a very slow fourth quarter, both in terms of news about renewed legislative initiatives in a handful of states, as well as opinion pieces, mostly in those states, that were both pro and con on the subject. The legislation appears to be moving this election year in Maryland, Minnesota, and New Hampshire, moving quickly, particularly in Minnesota so far. And Colorado is looking to join Vermont and Oregon in liberalizing its medical aid and dying laws, something that the anti-forces warned would happen once medical aid and dying was legalized. Advocates would come back and liberalize and liberalize and liberalize. Hospital troubles are not going away. Congressional scrutiny of what happens when private equity acquires a local hospital. Tenet continuing to shrink its network with announced hospital sales in South Carolina and Orange County, California. And Steward, which was once considered a gold standard for a mid-sized for-profit hospital chain, appears to be in dire financial straits, if you believe the reporting in the Boston Globe and other sources, and is actually threatening to close four hospitals in Massachusetts, which would have a huge impact on the hospital sector throughout the state. And on the hospice side, one of the most troubling stories, in my opinion, comes out of Michigan, where McLaren Hospital announced at the end of January it was closing its Highland Cottage Hospice House in Petoskey, Michigan. Its second such closure in just a few months of a local hospice house. And what makes the story troubling is that when McLaren announced it was closing its first hospice house in Sheboygan, Michigan, the Petoskey community rallied to support the Highland Cottage and sought assurances from McLaren that it wouldn't shut Highland. Both of these houses, while owned by the hospital, were built largely with donations from the community. The community in Petoskey was vocal. McLaren was basically silent. It's a good lesson in how a provider should not manage a crisis situation or a potential crisis situation. So that's my thought, a little bit of quantitative, a little bit of qualitative on the month. I know we want to look at do some prospecting ahead for 2024 later on, but back to you to talk about your view.
Yeah, well, great job, first off, because, I mean, that was a pivot for you. I mean, instead of, like, you know, you're curating every morning, and so kudos. I like the way you actually did that. And again, for if we have any new listeners to the show, you know, Mark and I are kind of a yin and yang. Mark does it from the perspective of, what would you say, Mark, from a publicist, longtime, incredible marketing messaging experience. Would you edit that at all?
Somebody who's been doing news monitoring literally my entire career in public relations.
Thank you. And in fact, that's probably the most important part that I left out. And then my goal is to try to do it from a C-suite perspective. And in my hat's off to Court and Joy. I mean, Mark, you know, every great leader, right, wants people to pick up where we leave off and do even better. They've had a pretty dang good first month of, you know, from picking
impressive.
Up. Yeah, really impressive. Just kudos to both of them. Doing what I do, they've actually made my job a little bit easier. And part of it is I'm finally getting competent at this now that, you know, I've been doing it a year. But my curating time, because of the way they do it in their technology, has made it a little bit simpler for me. And also now I have a template, which you alluded, that's where we're going to go next. And a lot of people do like their prognostications in December. We thought, you know, you and I thought it'd be interesting to do it in our first show reviewing January. So we're going to go there in a second. So these are, I flagged 85 articles. And what I'm finding now is my categories are staying very similar. And interestingly, this category is going to have a lot to do with my prognostication. So the first category I just call mission moments, which to me is just preserving the essence of what hospice is. And so there's several great articles. The first one, this one actually was in the UK, A Smile in the Sky, drawn for a Worcester hospice patient. And basically a pilot drew a sky-high smile above St. Richard's Hospice. And so I thought that was actually pretty amazing. Hospice, so I'm gonna continue with hospice mission moments. Hospice nurse shares the unexplained experience with a patient that changed her view on death and dying. And this is about Nurse Julie. Mark, I can remember being in old National Hospice Work Group meetings, and I remember I was kind of the young, provocative one, and I said, can you imagine a reality TV show changing the perception of death and dying? And people are like, oh, wow, that's an amazing idea. Well, now you got like Nurse Hadley, Nurse Julie, that are, you know, literally putting things out in social media channels that are, it is actually moving the needle on people's perception of death and dying and kind of removing the the stigma and the fear. So that was a great call out. I think Nurse Julie has something like over 1 million followers and Nurse Hadley like 500,000. And so this young generation is using social media in an amazing way. So back to the mission moments. This was a beautiful one. Musician mom, 31, enters hospice in his final days, writes a song for her young son. My art is all I have to leave behind was kind of the title. And her name was Kat Janice. And the song was Dance You Out of My Head, which she wrote for her 7-year-old son. And that went viral. So another beautiful way of helping really impact people on what this amazing essence of great hospice care looks like. Of course, always because of the Carters, there was another great article about Rosalind Carter, about her impact on caregivers. And then there's one, Gentle Endings, Lessons Learned in Hospice for Those Without a Home. This actually was about the in-between in Salt Lake City, Utah. Really cool thing about that, Mark. And so when we started Teleas, our team said, you know, it's always awkward in the office to go, well, do I get a gift for that person? We said, you know what, let's take that off the table. Every year, we're going to pick a nonprofit that we choose as an organization. And instead of giving gifts to each other, we actually get together and try to make a bigger impact on the world. So that's the organization that Teleas' team chose this year, called The In-Between. And the cool thing is we actually had a matching grant this year. So we made a really nice gift to them. And so that was just a great article. And so The In-Between is a hospice residence for people that are homeless. So really cool mission moment. And then our friends at Carolina Caring, hospice patient enjoys fishing adventure. Mark, my very first hospice moment at 25 in Pensacola was a very similar circumstance. So that one literally almost moved me to tears and kind of brought me back to my very early days of kind of falling in love in this work that we do. And let's see here, Pout of Medicine. This is kind of cool in a different way. Pout of Medicine, this was out of Atrium Health. Palliative medicine helps a stage 4 melanoma survivor reclaim life after treatment. So there's a really great article of the power of palliative care. And then high impact articles, core role and responsibilities of physicians in hospice care, a statement by and for U.S. hospice and palliative care physicians. Our good friend, Journal of Palliative Medicine by Ira Byock and other hospice and palliative care physicians concerned about hospice care. And of course, Dr. Byock, actually, that was one of our last shows of last year. Actually, it was a great show. And so I just want to call that article out. And then just last one under mission moments, Mark, this was really cool. It was in Psychology Today, How to Live What the Dying Tell Us. And there were 5 key points in that article. Number one, and this is wisdom, I think, for all of us. And I feel sometimes those of us that are so close to hospice and palliative care, maybe we're so close and we forget this wisdom, which is why I wanted to call it out. Number one, I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. Number two, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. You and I don't know what we'd say about that one, Mark. Number three, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. Number four, I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. And number five, I wish I'd let myself be happier. That was a really cool article. So that was my first category. Next category was, I call it hospice reimbursement challenges, warning signs, implications. So there was an article in Home Health News about in-home care providers await updates on CMS's Medicaid proposal, begin preparing for the 80-20 rule. I actually think this is a cool idea, Mark. So effectively, it's basically kind of capping like 80% of your money needs to go to care. And so capping the 20% is left over maybe for overhead and margin. That's an interesting approach. And there's something very similar that you probably know in probably the insurer kind of Medicare Advantage world. And so I want to call that out. That might be an interesting tactic or toolbox we could kind of throw out as we think about future reimbursement design, et cetera. Next one was evaluation of the Medicare Care Choices Model, MCCM, the final report. And so it was actually talking about some of the positive outcomes from the MCCM, which was more of a concurrent care model. And then, again, keeping under reimbursement, 46% of C-suite executives in healthcare, so this comes out of Becker's, are prioritizing cost reduction. You're going to see we're going to bring that back to themes I'm predicting for this year. The next one, this is Home Healthcare News. Home health benefit will become a skeleton if Medicare payment adjustments continue. Industry leader cautions. And then next one, MedPAC approves hospital physician pay bump, doubles down on post-acute cuts. And so MedPAC is basically recommending cuts for the post-acute realm for 2025, but pay raises for hospitals. and physicians, which I don't disagree with the physicians, but if the future is healthcare in the home, that's kind of an interesting one. And so, of course, MedPAC has a lot of methodologies by which they do what they do. Next in out-of-home care news, surveys show 2024 to be the year of efficiency for care-at-home organizations. So it feels like we got some early warning signs that 2024 is going to be a cost-cutting year for many healthcare industries. And again, another one, MedPAC votes to recommend home health payment cut and hospice update to freeze. So that's kind of even further down in the weeds on that MedPAC recommendation. And then last one, and you called this one out, Mark, care planning issues, top list of hospice survey deficiencies. And so that was in an article in Hospice News. So my next category is Medicare Advantage. So these first ones I say are implications to hospice reimbursement. I always put Medicare Advantage under that as kind of a sub point because we know Medicare Advantage is going to have a lot of interesting implications to reimbursement in the future. So all of these are really interesting, Mark. In October, I start to pick up on negativity towards Medicare Advantage. And there are some, so here's the first one. Has Medicare Advantage lost its luster? This was in Becker's. Next one, denied by artificial intelligence, denied by AI, how Medicare Advantage plans use algorithms to cut care off for seniors in need. And so that was a pretty big article. And then here's a blockbuster. The government is expected to pay Medicare Advantage plans $88 billion more than it paid for fee-for-service in 2024. This is going to get to a prediction I'm going to have a little bit later for theme this year. And this MedPAC report was released shortly after UnitedHealthcare Group reported a $22 billion in profit in 2023, a almost 15% revenue jump. Then a couple more under that theme. Will we close the Medicare Advantage primary gap in 2024? That was in MedCity News. This one was in McKnight's. As denials climb, MedPAC approves recommendations for managed care oversight. And then a KFF article, older Americans say that they feel trapped in Medicare Advantage plans. And I promise you, I'm not just trying to pick out. I've seen more mounting volume of these. Mm-hmm. This one was interesting, Mark, in Houston. Memorial Hermann drops Humana Medicare Advantage. I think some healthcare people are kind of drawing a line and saying, it's just not worth it, which is interesting. It is kind of a pushback. Some pushback. Wall Street Journal.
You know, five years ago, you never would have seen a negative story about Medicare Advantage. It was all, this is where the future is going, and every provider needs to jump on this train before it leaves the station. And the Medicare Advantage providers had this great head start, and they haven't managed it as well as they could have. And now they're dealing with a less than favorable environment, at least from some perspectives, political and media, as well as consumer.
Well said. The next one, Wall Street Journal exclusive. Cigna nears deal to offload its Medicare business. So that's kind of interesting. And then last one is from a CMS report. Evaluation of phase two of the Medicare Advantage value-based insurance design, as we all know, is VBID, is the acronym, model test. First 3 years of implementation, the executive summary is mixed results. And so that's the summary on that one. And then there was an article that was the 10 biggest Medicare Advantage stories in 2023, but I'm not going to regurgitate it because it really is a lot of similar. So my next category, I just say competition to be aware of. As we know, we go forward, there's so many different flavors of competition coming towards hospice palliative care programs. So the first one, Medicare certifies hospices in California despite the state ban on new licenses. And so that was an Ava Kaufman article, and we know that Ava sure has created a lot of interesting year for us in 2023 mm-hmm. with their exposés, especially some of these fraudulent hospices. This next one, Best Buy Health Plans Bigger Healthcare Presence in 2024. That was an article, and they're actually partnering with Atrium and to talk about more hospital-level care at home. This next article, acute hospital care at home data release fact sheet. So this is just some data around hospital at home. And then this next category, again, all in the spirit of competition, but this one more in the M&A, merger and acquisition realm. PE firms adapting hospice roll-up strategies. I just was at Homecare 100 a couple weeks ago. Definitely saw a lot of that. So private equity firms in the hospice space are adapting their roll-up strategies as economic uncertainties persist. Next one is Scientific American. Hospice providers must be better regulated. Too many hospice providers in the U.S. are run by private equity and for-profit corporations. So again, that's a theme I'm going to call out that I don't think is going to go away. And I don't think that's a bad thing that it doesn't go away. KFF, to tackle financial distress, hospitals and health systems are turning to mergers, which again, Mark, I think is going to get to some of you and I's predictions. Our sponsor of this show, StateServe, announces acquisition of DeltaCareRx. So StateServe and DeltaCareRx are coming together, and they have some future innovations envisioned as you kind of bring those two ancillary service offerings together. This one in hospice news, to affiliate or acquire, trends in nonprofit hospice consolidation. So certainly our readers are hearing trends here. And then this was in MedCity News. St. Luke's merger will be the first of many M&A deals in the hospital sector this year. And then the last one in this section, BrightSpring Health files to go public for the second time. BrightSpring Health Services officially filed plans for an initial public offering. The home and community-based service provider first planned to go public in 2021, but decided against it. Now they're going full speed ahead. So then my next category, Mark, is workforce challenges. And then I always have three sub-stratifications under that. The first one is these articles paint the picture of the issue. So I had several there. Policymakers and providers must take steps to prevent staff mass turnover, researchers say. That was a McKnight's article. And then another McKnight's article, healthcare ranks second among industries with workers frustrated by low pay. And then another interesting one, danger on the job. Workers suffer the most injuries in these top 25 jobs. Unfortunately, healthcare had number 3, number 5, number 6, number 10, number 11, number 20, number 23, and number 24. And 4 is the top 25 areas for most injuries on the job. And then the last one in that first category, profound financial workforce challenges persist for senior living providers as 2024 begins. My next category under staffing challenges, say these are like the implications of the staffing issue. And so CMS confirms nursing home staffing ratios to finalize this year. That whole issue of, well, the government's going to mandate, we fix the problem. But yet there's this huge outcry because 85% of nursing homes cannot comply with the staffing mandate. And so Dr. Bayak and I debated that a little bit because he was talking about staffing ratios. And I think we could learn a lesson, but I also don't think it's throw the baby out with the bathwater. But just their kind of one size fits all approach for the nursing home, I think is a good caution for us. And then this is the last category. And these are the ones that give me hope, Mark. And I notice as we look through the rearview mirror of 2023, I start to see more and more articles of the solutions to the staffing challenge. So that's my third subcategory under staffing. New grant-funded healthcare high schools aim to help address North Carolina staffing shortages. That was a really great article. Another one, home-based leaders are focusing on culture, creative benefits to mitigate staffing challenges. And then under, this was in the U.S. News and World Report, best healthcare jobs in 2024. Hopefully that mitigated those top injury jobs. And then this next one was sleep pods, coffee bars, and co-working spaces. Hospital staff lounges get a makeover. And so kind of taking a page from Silicon Valley and how that's actually coming to staff lounges in healthcare. And then this one titled A Not-So-Silent Battle, Tackling Nursing Burnout with Innovative Solutions. And then interesting news subpoints in that article, the need for innovation, mobile communication for patient care, education, training, and the role of clinical scorecards. All right, the next one is, we're college students with ideas of how to promote senior living careers to a younger generation. Some really great, like, you know, basically they are the focus group, right? So college students and ideas of how to pitch to the younger generation to recruit them into healthcare. Another article is healthcare ready to embrace more young nurses. We're going to have to. When you look at the millennials and Gen Y, they're going to have to be part of the solution to just the volume silver tsunami versus the number of people needed to actually take care of the silver tsunami. So then my next category, Mark, I continue to call it patient, family, and future customer demographics and trends. And so I really start to see a lot of articles, which I find heartening, because if you get an idea of the trends, then you will know how to navigate. So here's a few. Seniors spend the equivalent of 3 weeks a year on healthcare, study shows. That's actually sad. So can we mitigate that? Of course, there's a lot of the argument of hospice and palliative care. And so viewpoint, care fragmentation, care continuity, and care coordination, how they differ and why it matters. This actually was a JAMA article. Healthcare in the U.S. is characterized by fragmentation, with many patients seeing multiple physicians. 35% of Medicare beneficiaries saw five or more physicians. So I think that's a problem to be solved. Next one, anorexia nervosa, evaluating disparities. I probably didn't say that right, Mark. Evaluating disparities in places of death. And the United States, over 22 years using the CDC Wonder database. Lot of interesting data, too much for me to cover in this show. Study found that death in home and hospice was more common than in medical or hospital nursing facilities in all four analyzed groups. And there's a lot of kind of sub points under that. Let's see, another one. Why hospice utilization rates have fallen? This is a Hospice News. National hospice utilization rates have fallen since 2020, although the total number of patients served remain consistent. Of course, we know COVID played a large part in that. Several good mutual friends of you and I have used the term, there was a death pull forward. So COVID pulled some deaths forward. Those may have been people we would have been served in the serving in the future. Another big kind of statistic or trend, the 100 Club. Mark, I'm praying you're going to be part of this. Yeah. U.S. centenarians are set to quadruple by 2054, and I hope I'm going to follow in your path in that too. As life expectancies increase and birth rates decline, U.S. is anticipated to trend older in the coming decades. So we're going to see more and more centenarians as we go forward in the future. And this is one, Mark, you've called out in the past. As a big trend, rural hospitals are caught in an aging infrastructure conundrum. Just the whole challenge of they can't upgrade their capital structure because their reimbursement situation, and which hence the word conundrum. Here's another one. Is healthcare relying too much on family caregivers? And then it was a Modern Healthcare article. The Biden administration is demanding hospitals offer more clarity to family members on their role in home-based services. This one was out of the Falls Church News Press. A looming crisis, millennials caring for their aging parents. Millennials, which are between 1981 and 96, comprise roughly 73 million Americans. By 2030, all boomers and over 70 million Americans in total will be ages 65 or older. This represents a 25% increase, and just then goes on to talk about how that millennial generation may end up being the ones tapped on the shoulder to be asked to care for that generation. Sustainability of our healthcare system. This was actually from the JP Morgan conference. I've actually got some sub points when we get to our trends under that one. But the discussion at this JP Morgan conference, sustainability of our healthcare system, and talking about the concern, the status quo is an existential threat to our healthcare system. And they're worried at the same time that the healthcare system is losing the public's trust, which makes it only harder to fix the system, while also delivering quality of care and accessibility to our population. And then another one under trend, it's unbelievable how a retired congresswoman's son found her months before death. This just concerned me, Mark. I bet you picked up on this one. She was 89 years old, trailblazing politician Eddie Bernice Johnson, a Democrat in Texas, should not have died on December 31st. She was the first nurse ever elected to Congress. Johnson's family plans to sue Baylor Scott and White Health, claiming negligent post-surgery care at the hospital's rehab center that led to her death. She was known as EBJ, and she represented the Dallas area Congress for 30 years. That is not the type of press that you want. Everyone is important, but that is definitely not the kind of press you want on someone who's had such a great history in healthcare. So the next one is the prevalence of hospital diagnostic errors. Nearly a fourth of patients who are transferred in ICU or die in hospitals are misdiagnosed. So that was a trend. Home health agencies grapple with the acuity creep as patient needs become more complex. As we've seen for years, Mark, right? The hospital has to get them out quicker and quicker so that if you push one part of the balloon, that acuity is showing up in the community and in the home in a lot of different ways. And let's see, just one more under, I didn't realize I had picked out so many trend articles this month. Quality of data on profit status reported via Care Compare. This was in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. Our good friend Joan Tino, we had her on the show last year. For-profit hospice providers differ in key process areas of care and bereaved family care perceptions of the quality of care. And then they just really basically are stratifying and delineating quality of care difference based upon profit status. So those are my trends. luckily I only have, my next ones only have just a few. Regulatory and political, I just had one I called out. Scrutiny to private equity's involvement in healthcare. Higher prices, worse outcomes do not serve patients. That was a Boston Globe by the editorial board. So then my next category is technology intervention. I do have a few here. One that we've got to be careful of. I guess you could also just say this is a trend, but healthcare data breaches hit new highs in 2023. That was called out in Modern Healthcare. A record 133 million, just think about that, individuals were impacted by healthcare data breaches in 2023. Also under technology, chatbot performance in defining and differentiating palliative care, supportive care, and hospice care. Now, this was maybe a cautionary tale. They actually looked at artificial intelligence and how good it's kind of navigating where, which service line patients should be in. Executive summary is, we're not quite there yet. And Jeff and I use a lot of artificial intelligence and some of our tools and what we do. And I think we could kind of say the same thing. It's the interesting thing is that it's rapidly improving. The more data you feed it, the quicker it gets smarter. So next one, McKnight's, lack of incentives bar home health hospice providers from creating interoperable solutions. Long-term and post-acute organizations have not received the same support as other care settings, especially for interoperability. Amen. I've been saying that for a long time and finally got an article kind of backing it up, which is one reason why we don't exactly have a love relationship with our EMRs, but I'm going to have a prediction about that when we get to trends. Health systems want tech to make it more human or to make their healthcare delivery more human. That was in Becker's. Predictive analytics in action, how machine learning is driving successful outcome for value-based end-of-life care programs. This was interesting, Mark. I bet you picked up on this. Microsoft seeking a chief medical officer. Huh? Microsoft is looking for a chief medical officer. That should tell us something. And then Becker's article, what Amazon's latest healthcare play could mean for ASCs, which is ambulatory surgical centers. And then here's the 7 health tech predictions for 2024, which in just a second, Mark, I'll let us segue to our trend predictions. So number one, enhanced user-friendly digital technology, multi-problem solutions, AI integration, healthcare that starts at home, increased investment in proactive care, aging population focus, diversification of revenue streams, and how health tech platforms are going to enable all of those trends. And then just the last couple to round out my last couple categories. This category I'm just calling the speed of change and resiliency. In other words, we live at a very interesting time, and so there's a lot of change coming at us. And this just says creative thinking is needed to save rural hospitals. And so just talking about the challenge of rural hospitals, and they really got to think outside the box. And Mark, you and I are involved in a fascinating email exchange between you and I and a CEO in Kansas. And it wasn't about rural hospitals, but it was even about more of their community and economy. And I thought that was brilliant. I won't say what it was, but to me it's that type of bold thinking is going to be needed in certain sectors, especially the rural hospitals where we're going to end up with healthcare deserts if we don't do something different.
You know, the irony there is that one of the solutions is 50 years old. When you look at so many of the small rural exurban hospitals, they were either built or they were modernized and expanded with money from a federal program called Hill-Burton, which provided essential capital funding to rural and exurban facilities. That money ran out, I think, in the 70s. Or 80s, but it was you can't go into a rural community and not find a hospital that didn't have Hill-Burton money on it. And they and places like Florida, where there used to be a healthcare cost containment board that published annual financial data, you would actually see they had to amortize the Hill-Burton money over 25 years, actually. So you would, I remember looking at hospital cost reports when I was at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami and still seeing some Hill-Burton money being reported at some smaller hospices in the state of Florida. It worked.
Wow.
But, you know, it was federal money, which some people think is evil. It was an infrastructure program, which has been polarized in today's environment. But one hates to think what rural healthcare would look like today if there had not been a Hill-Burton program. And the question, and the interesting thing is, you know, no rural advocates are out there saying, hey, we had a solution and it worked. Why don't we do it again?
That's fascinating, Mark. I've never heard that before. Yeah. When did that run out? Do you know?
I'm not an expert on it. It, you know, I was at Jackson in the early 90s and you were still seeing, you know, some of that 25-year amortization playing out, but it was mostly, it had its heyday in the 60s, I believe. I do not know whether it was part of the Great Society.
I wonder that.
It might have actually, well, it might have been passed during the Eisenhower Kennedy years, actually. I don't know, but, it worked. But, wow. You know, heaven forbid we should go bring back something that worked, especially if it involves federal money.
Well, maybe you and I could solve things because you know what? Yeah. You know, I think we always try to stay away from politics, but I think probably you and I are two ends of the spectrum, but we love working with each other because really about solutions, not, you know, what side mm-hmm. of the coin are you on? And that's what's so sad about today is let's bring common sense back and actually make solutions because there is a place for, I totally get what you're saying. There is a place because if you just go to the major metropolitan areas, well, then you're going to end up with these deserts. And how do you make investment smartly? And look what it did for those communities actually over the years. So, wow, that's pretty cool.
One of the last hospitals, small hospitals that closed last year in Missouri, it closed very suddenly. And one of the things the CEO said was, you know, infrastructure falling apart and we don't have the money to deal with it. We can't modernize. So we got to close.
Wow. Well, Mark, I have one last category and we're going to go to our trends. And so this category, I'm going to call it the human factor. And so this is an article, doctors are pushing Hollywood for more realistic depictions of death and dying on TV. I thought that was pretty cool. And yeah, because that shapes culture. And so kudos that they're actually they're pushing for that. So Mark, let's segue now.
And that actually, Chris, is something that is being repeated. There was a Robert Wood Johnson funded initiative in the early 2000s called Last Acts, where they were working with one segment of that was working with writers, producers, directors, creative types in Hollywood to better portray end-of-life situations on television and movies. And, you know, the Last Acts experts were available for consults with TV showrunners, for example. And they staged a number of events out in Hollywood for the creative community. They brought in experts. I remember attending an event that had John Milch from Hospice Buffalo, whose brother was a major figure in television production, the genius behind NYPD Blue. I remember Susan Toll, who recently retired from Oregon Health Science University and a leading bioethicist, particularly with an emphasis on end-of-life care, was a panelist, as well as one of the VITAS founders. That's why I was out there, was a panelist. But, you know, they did some good work, and the funding ran out, and nobody picked it up. And now we're back to square one doing the same thing 20 years later.
I'm like feeling like there is a theme I didn't predict, which is what is old is new, or it should be. Well, let's segue, Mark. So again, a lot of folks do these kind of shows in December. We thought it'd be much cooler to do it now. So kind of your prediction of kind of themes or trends we're going to see this year, and then I'll do the same.
Yeah, I broke mine down to two types, the very obvious themes and the not so obvious. And I'm doing this not from the perspective of the care continuum as a whole, but from the hospice perspective. So my top five most obvious themes are mergers and acquisitions, including affiliations among like-minded not-for-profits, as well as roll-up strategies by for-profits, publicly traded and private equity funded. Medical aid in dying, it's an election year. And this, in those states that have Democratic legislatures and Democratic governors, the consensus after the last election was that Let's hold this off for an election year where we can force Republicans to take a vote on a social issue that 70% of the population is in favor of. So we will see some votes on medical aid and dying this year, at least in Democratic states. Labor activism is going to continue in the healthcare sector, and I believe it will continue to bleed ever so slightly over onto the post-acute side of the sector. Number four, I think for-profits, mostly private equity, will continue to come under attack and investigation in this election year. But that, you know, not-for-profits, particularly on the hospital side, do not have a pristine record on things like community benefit and meeting community need. And so not-for-profits will not be immune to attack and investigation. And there's always the risk that those attacks on not-for-profits in the hospital sector, again, can bleed over into the post-acute sector. And finally, nursing homes will continue to be under tremendous stress, and that will have an impact on the hospice world. And, you know, we should keep in mind that a lot of those fraudulent or fly-by-night for-profit hospices that you mentioned earlier, a lot of them build their business in the nursing home side. Yep. And so it'll be interesting to see how stress in the nursing home sector plays out in the for-profit, not-for-profit divide in the hospice sector. So five topics, themes that I think are not quite so obvious, although they're certainly not hidden. I think just as you're going to see medical aid and dying moving in Democratic states in this election year, I think you'll see continued efforts to roll back certificate of need in Republican and Southern states this year, if only because it's likely that those supermajorities in some of those Republican states might dwindle a bit after the 2024 election. So this would probably be the time for the libertarians who want to destroy certificate of need to strike this year while they have what might be the largest political majority that they're going to have in the near future. My second question is, you know, we mentioned NHPCO a little bit when you mentioned Dr. Byock. You know, how will the combined NAHC and NHPCO evolve, particularly in terms of how it negotiates or how it navigates the for-profit, not-for-profit divide in hospice? You know, there's not as much of a divide in the home health sector, so NAHC doesn't necessarily bring the same perspective on that or same history as NHPCO. And, you know, one question is, in terms of a not-for-profit perspective, will the NAHC-NHPCO merger end up being a boost to the National Partnership for Hospice Innovation? Certainly might seem likely there. Third, less obvious theme is the growth of collaborative networks and affiliations versus outright mergers on the not-for-profit side in hospice. I don't see that dying out. It's just a matter of, it's a long decision-making tale for most not-for-profit boards to get to that point. And there have been a lot of discussions in recent years, so that means they're slowly moving toward making a decision, perhaps. Fourth, pharmacy deserts and drug shortages, how they affect both rural areas and inner-city neighborhoods, and what does that do for hospice providers, and what does that do for the pharmacy benefit managers who are playing increasingly important roles in the provision of hospice care? And my fifth least obvious is hospital financial ills, closures, the spreading of hospital deserts in rural areas. I don't think the hospice sector fully appreciates how that is a risk to the how big a risk that can be to the hospice sector. And I think we need to continue to keep our eye on that.
Those are good.
So those are my themes.
Damn, those are good. Those are really good. I mean, I'm just sitting there going, man, that is like gold right there. So I took a broader perspective. I actually really like yours. And so first off, there was, when I was going to incorporate this into the top news stories of the month, but you know, some smart people at Becker's. And so Becker's Hospital Review had the 12 healthcare trends and issues we're following for 2024. I just want to call that out. First off, number one, healthcare has a worsening numbers problem, and it's talking about staff compared to volume, but also the economic model. Number two, payers have become massive. United Healthcare is over $200 billion now. Number three, the largest employer of physicians is one of the world's largest insurers. I think I just said who they were. Number four, governmental healthcare payers between Medicare and Medicaid are now combined to be larger than the commercial payer sources. Number five, technology is part of the solution, but not the entire solution. Number six, the movement to value-based care is still very much a work in process. Number seven, Medicare Advantage now covers more than half of the Medicare population. Number eight, mental and behavioral health in the United States has reached a critical stage with a worsening imbalance of needs and demands versus supply. This is one that really bothers me, Mark, and I'm, several different ways I'm trying to figure out how to wrestle with this one. Number nine, Washington, D.C. tends to make noise about the impact of private equity in healthcare. I guess you could insinuate what they tend to make noise about it, but are they going to do anything about it? It's a tough one to do something about. Number 10, aging well and preventive health is seeing a growth in interest. Number 11, diabetes, obesity drugs can have a large positive long-term impact on healthcare. And number 12, hospital margins largely improved in 2023. But hospitals face huge long-term financial challenges. So that was really good from Becker. So here's my own. And interestingly, since it's a prediction of trends or themes, this is exactly how I'm going to continue to organize what I'm harvesting each month, Mark, that I hope C-suite leaders don't lose. The first one is, hopefully there will continue to be a theme of mission moments. Although I want to kind of put a caution, there have been some bad healthcare stories, especially in hard to staff areas, really feel like a warning sign. There is one in Atlantic Journal Constitution, a 78-year-old veteran's final days at a Georgia senior care home, raising troubling questions about care of the facility and the state's oversight. Why I'm calling that out is I pray that we see a lot of great mission moments like I called out today, where staffing is challenging. Then we're going, oh, that horrible facility. They can't get staff. They don't have any staff. It's horrible. And, you know, what do we expect in a situation like that? So maybe we'll have an adult conversation about it this year. And then there may be under mission moments. Will 2024 be the tipping point for health equity where we're honest about it and we're going to do something about it? Because there are a lot of challenges in the health equity space. My second theme, I predict, I'm going to continue to be reimbursement challenges and warning signs and implications to our future reimbursement. You saw in a lot of the kind of prediction earlier on our articles, a lot of people are going to be cost cutting this year, tightening their belts and shoring up their financials. I think you're going to see a lot of that. Medicare Advantage, I think we're going to see a lot more negative press this year, Mark, about Medicare Advantage plans. And at least, I mean, they're not a panacea. They're not a silver bullet. And maybe they've been a victim of their own success, so to speak. But I think there's some very real problems that we need to call out. I mean, especially like the artificial intelligence where within seconds you get a denial of a claim, and that's just kind of how the system works. Third category, competition. We're going to continue to see more and more competition, more merger and acquisition, as you predicted. And I do think there's going to be more scrutiny and debate about this whole role of private equity in healthcare. That's a tough one. I don't know what the solution is, but it seems like we need to have an adult conversation about it. Number four, we're going to continue to see workplace challenges or workforce challenges, just the volume of need compared to staffing. I do pray we're going to see a lot more solutions. And here's the cool thing that I've seen last year that I believe this trend is going to continue. The employee is going to continue to be elevated. Duh. Feels like a dumb moment, but it should be. And so that's one positive amidst this challenge is you have a scarce resource, appreciating our most amazing asset we have, which is the people that are giving the care. Fifth, I think we're going to continue to see macro trends because the demographic is shifting of people getting healthcare as our baby boomers are aging. I think there's going to be a lot more enlightening data. And if we're paying attention, What do we learn from that data and how does it shift our care models? Of course, there's going to be lots of regulatory and political wrangling. Of course, this is going to be a big election year. So there'll be a lot of articles around that. Next category, we're going to see a whole lot under technology and innovations. But here's a prediction amongst that, that I believe we're going to see more direct-to-consumer products in healthcare and application of technology in that space. And what can we learn from that in the hospice and palliative care space? And here's a kind of bold prediction. I feel like hospice, electronic medical records are finally going to start to get better. I probably could do a whole show, maybe I will this year, about kind of why it's been such a challenging situation. You know, just simplistically, where the biggest organizations are providing EMRs to hospitals. We've been at the tail end of healthcare, and there hasn't been a whole lot of place for resource and private equity money, but that is changing. It's not. I'm not saying it's going to be fixed in the next year. I just think the trend line, like our worst years are behind us and our better years are ahead of us as far as tools in the hospice and palliative care space and technology tools. And then the last category is just the speed of change and resiliency, just our ability to deal with change. My wife gave me a Christmas present 3 years ago, and it talked about kind of trends in history. And about every 120 years or so, there's just a massive amount of change. Guess what? We live in one of those times. And so the ability to be resilient and to be able to maybe even throw change out of our lexicon, and it's just about innovation and growing and just rising to the challenge of our day. And so I think we're going to see a lot of articles on both sides of that equation. So those are my theme predictions. Any final thoughts, Mark?
It will, you know, Confucius has cursed us to live in interesting times.
Well, Mark, we're just a truncated masterclass. We had a lot to cover this month, but I think your masterclass is always appreciated. So you want to end us with that?
Sure. Two tips for hospice leaders regarding their written communications. These are tips that I give every one of my clients and anybody else who asks for advice on how they can do a better job of communicating. So my first tip, find and recruit a writing coach. Whether you have a skilled writer on your staff, which very few hospices do these days, or whether you try to make do with someone who is not an experienced writer on your staff, everyone can benefit from a second set of eyes on their copy and the counsel of a seasoned writer. For a hospice, you can look to retired teachers, journalists, public relations practitioners, or marketers among your volunteers. And if that doesn't work out, then just try going to people who work in those professions and asking them if they would mentor whoever the writer on your staff is. I've done a lot of that mentoring over the years, and it's fun and it's rewarding. The second recommendation, pick a style guide, or two or three, actually. Most people use the AP style guide, but you can also use the style guides that are published by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post used to publish one. And then complement that with a classic how-to guide, which for me is Strunk and White's Elements of Style, which is almost 100 years old now and still incredibly relevant. And then add something more modern to complement provide a different perspective than Strunk and White. Woe Is Me by Patricia O'Connor, Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, or Dreyer's English. Books like that can be really helpful in turning an okay writer into a very good writer.
Wow. Thank you, Mark. Well, to our listeners, it's been a long show, but we have a lot to cover. Mark, always appreciate having you. We're looking forward to having you next month, and we continue. And to our listeners, we'll always end with a quote. This one was chosen by Mark, and Mark, I think, is even more profound now that we've done the show. It's from George Santayana, the Spanish-American writer and philosopher. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And then I would add, are not. Thanks for listening to TCN Talks.